Well, hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Shane Show, my podcast here on YouTube and iTunes, and thank you for tuning in today. I want to thank everybody who has subscribed to my YouTube page, as well as the podcast on iTunes. It was exciting to get those first subscriptions, and I'm really looking forward to getting more as the show progresses and gets a little bit more mature. So thank you so much to everyone for taking time out of your busy schedule and viewing and listening schedules to listen to me ramble on about some of the headlines that I find funny or interesting on a weekly basis, and for subscribing to my YouTube page and iTunes podcast. This week I've got another big show for everybody. We've got an exciting show. My guest this week is Matt Natto. He is a stand-up and sketch comedian from groups like The Sketchersons and Sunday Night Live at the Comedy Bar here in Toronto. As well, I'm also going to talk about some of the biggest headlines from the last 2 weeks while we were gone, including the Pan Am Games here in Toronto, Greece's current situation within the Eurozone and the Euro currency in Europe, and some other things like weird happenings in sports and some talk about people on money and who should be represented on currencies around the world. So again, before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that you can follow me on Twitter at STR O'Neill for all information about the show, the podcast, upcoming shows, as well as stuff that I find interesting. I retweet a lot of other people's stuff on my Twitter account because I think it's funny or I think it's valuable content and information. So give it a follow there and you might just enjoy it. As well, it's the same account on Instagram. Here you can follow all of my hilarious picture taking. That's at STR O'Neill on Instagram. As well, you can email the show anytime at shaneshow.to@gmail.com. You can send me any news, notes, information, telegrams, anything you want, even anonymous tips on certain stuff that you may have come across. Again, I encourage whistleblowers to bring me any information that they have and any news that they want to be given out there. And one final thing before we start the show for today, I want to wish everybody a happy belated Canada Day across our great nation from sea to sea to sea. As well, happy Independence Day for all of my American listeners out there last week. It was a great week off, a great day off for everyone, and it was like a pretty great week as well here in Toronto. The rain held off last Wednesday for the holiday, and it looked like stuff was pretty good across the United States for their Independence Day holiday. Now, on to headlines. So this week, the Pan Am Games are set to begin here in Toronto. Preliminary events are scheduled to start on Thursday, and we're recording this on Thursday, so some of the preliminary events are going to get going tonight for some of the sports and the events, while the opening ceremonies go down tomorrow night on Friday over at the former Sky Dome. It's an exciting time. The Athletes Village is filling up. I work around the Athletes Village periodically, and it's pretty neat to see all of the athletes in their team uniforms wandering around. I've seen a lot of members from the Puerto Rican athletic team, as well as, you know, you see Canadians wearing all their track gear. I've seen some Americans, Mexicans, and I believe the Argentinians I caught over at the Harbor Castle Hotel. So it's pretty interesting and exciting to see all these different people coming to the city to take part in an athletic event. Obviously, it's very easy to be cynical about these sorts of things, and these sorts of athletic events aren't going to be perfect in any case. I mean, just look at the Olympics and some of the problems that have been caused in various Olympic host cities around the world, but when we're in the thick of it, you know, it's pretty exciting to see all these amateur athletes compete for their countries and to try to, reach the limits of their sports and their athletic endeavors. And it's exciting to see that. And it's important to remember that these athletes, for the most part, are amateurs. So it's exciting to see that spirit of athletics, you know, take over a city like this, and to have it right here in our backyard is pretty neat. Next up, you may have heard that earlier this week, the country of Greece held a referendum on the terms of the bailout to help the country finance its debt. Now, there's a lot of economic talk here, and it's been a very, we'll call it economist wonk heavy conversation around what's actually going on in Greece. I will be the first person to admit that I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert in the euro as a currency or the European Union as a body, but I have taken a few university courses on European politics as well as the European Union, and I do have a base level understanding of sort of what's going on there. And if we can frame the discussion in a way that most people understand, then it's pretty easy to see well, not maybe not easy, but at least easier to understand what's going on over there. And one of the ways that helps me understand these complex issues is by looking at numbers. And so I present to you the Grexit, a numbers game, which will be my personal breakdown of what's going on in Greece. And I will say that all of this data has been collected from sources such as the Washington Post, the Economist magazine, and in institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. So thank you so much to those sources for providing this information, and I encourage everyone to go out and give them a read. So my first number is going to be 180%. That's the current size of Greece's debt level compared to their GDP. That means the size of their debt is 180% bigger than the amount of money that they generated in their economy last year. That's really big. That's obviously concerning to have a debt level that's almost, you know, two times the size of their GDP. And that's sort of getting at the heart of why they're in an economic depression and nothing can seem to get going for Greeks in terms of their economy. The next number I'm going to share is 89.5%. 89.5% is the amount of unpaid tax receipts in Greece for the financial year of 2010. That's concerning for a lot of reasons. That means 89% of people and businesses that were expected to pay tax in Greece failed to do so in 2010. And 2010 is basically seen to be the peak of the economic crisis over there in Greece. And it's essentially the paramount of what they've been trying to dig themselves out of since then. To give some context to that, only 2.3% of tax receipts in Germany went unpaid in the same year. And that's sort of the heart of why the other countries in the Eurozone, and again, the Eurozone are countries that share the euro as a currency. That's 19 countries overall, which isn't every country in the EU. It's just countries, major countries like France, Germany, Spain, Ireland, Greece, Italy, and some of the smaller countries like Cyprus and other ones, which are harder to pronounce and, you know, less influential in terms of overall economic growth. But it's still important to recognize that that's almost 90% of people and businesses in Greece unable to pay their taxes in 2010. I don't have data for anything more recent than that, but that's still concerning, obviously, because it wasn't that long ago, only half a decade, and we're still seeing the effects of that, we'll call it history of tax evasion or tax avoidance in Greece. And that's sort of, well, that's a big reason why they're in the hole that they're in right now. So my next stat is 55%. 55% is the unemployment rate for Greeks 25 and under, according to the World Bank. The overall unemployment in Greece stands at roughly 30%, which, for the record, is higher than the unemployment rate in the United States at the height of the Great Depression in the 1930s, and is the highest in Europe at this time, as well as at any time since World War II, according to the Washington Post. That's very concerning. When anybody talks about setting a standard for economic depression and economic problems, they always refer to the Great Dust Bowl and the Great Depression of North America in the 1930s before the start of World War II. Obviously, Europe was also affected by the Great Depression. There were a lot of factors that played into it. Obviously, the stock market, the collapse of the late 1920s, the Dust Bowl, which impacted agriculture across North America, European economies as well back in the 30s. But now we're seeing Greece, which isn't a small country. It's a small economy because they're having such problems, but it's not a small country, and it's definitely not an insignificant country in terms of world attention. And to have that sort of unemployment, not just for the overall population, but for people 25 and under, is incredibly concerning. This is the future of Europe, the future of Greece, the future of much of the world that just can't seem to find employment and solid employment in their home country of Greece. We're seeing youth unemployment at varying levels over the total unemployment rate of their countries. Across the world, I mean, the youth unemployment rate here in Canada is higher than it is than the overall unemployment rate, and this is concerning because the future of the economy lies obviously in the future taxpayers and the future workers in any country. So, for Greece to sort of solve their debt problem, yes, they need to pay back their creditors, they need to pay back the IMF and the European Central Bank, but they also need to find an economy and sort of build the industry for the next generation to fulfill. And get those people working again, find industries, and get them educated in some way to not only better those people's lives as individuals, but also to better the economy overall and create new industries and new growth in their countries. The next stat I'm going to drop here is 25%. 25% is the total drop in Greece's gross domestic product since 2008, and that's one of the biggest drops in an advanced economy that is not related to either the First or the Second World War. Basically, 25% drop in GDP over that time, again, is the same as the United States in the 1930s. It's similar to Canada in the late 1920s, and is within the same ballpark as post-war Germany and post-war France in the 1940s. Obviously, Greece hasn't suffered the same sort of infrastructure destruction that happened in Europe after World War II, and hasn't seen the sort of widely held depression that occurred in the United States. But it's a unique example of how a country can dig itself into a massive economic hole without having an excuse for it, essentially. I mean, Greece did this to themselves in many respects. You know, they weren't paying taxes. Greece had a massive problem in terms of people collecting pensions inappropriately and public servants taking advantage of public funds and their public paychecks. And that's sort of how they got to this $1 billion debt in terms of the EU. And to give us an idea of what that means for the Eurozone as a whole, and again, that's just countries that share the euro as a currency, not the European Union as a whole. 2%, that's Greece's contribution to the Eurozone's GDP. To give you an idea of the other countries that make that up, Germany and France make up 28 and 21% of the Eurozone's GDP, respectively. So Greece is a minnow in comparison to those other two countries, but overall, France and Greece are the major economic drivers for all of the Eurozone. And that's sort of why you're seeing the European Central Bank and those two countries in particular drag their feet and demand more austere measures and debt repayment plans from Greece, even though the people are unwilling to do so. So finally, my final stat is three. That number three, those are the things a government and a national central bank can do to alleviate debt and create money or growth. A growing economy needs a growing amount of money. That's how they define growth. Obviously, economists, and there are only really three practical ways that a country can do that. First way, you can borrow money from private banks and investors, either at home or internationally. That is what Greece did, and that's why they're having trouble paying them back, because they haven't been able to generate the revenue to pay their debtors. The second thing you can do is run a budget deficit to spend more than a country creates as measured by GDP. Greece also did this, and that's why their debt is now so huge, and that's why the euro as a currency is taking a hit, because 2% of their GDP isn't able to pay any of their debts back. And the third thing a country can do is bring in trade from other countries by running a trade surplus. This means selling more products abroad than you bring in through trade. This has worked around the world in many economies. Canada was the benefactor of this in terms of our natural resources for many years. Things are now changing, but many countries that are able to develop a trade surplus see the benefits of that in the very short term. A country like Ireland is a very good example of this. Ireland suffered its own debt problems at the start of the 21st century, just as the euro started going and Ireland joined in. And they've now sort of turned things around through creating new industries and shipping out more in trade and encouraging workers to come from other countries to Ireland to start businesses and pay into their economy. So again, that's just a brief look at what's going on in Greece. Again, I don't consider myself an economist. I can't even say the word very well. I don't consider myself an expert in European economic policy or the euro as a currency, but I do have a baseline understanding of the euro and the EU and the European Central Bank and how it operates. For those who are interested in learning more about this situation, I tweeted out actually last week an op-ed in the Globe and Mail written by Achim Hurlman. Achim was actually one of my professors on European policy at Carleton, and he did a really good breakdown of what the referendum meant in Greece and how it was really a game of chicken between the government in Greece and the rest of the European Eurozone countries like Germany and France, and sort of what the stakes were at. So I encourage you to read more about that, the Globe and Mail and the National Post have done a very good job of covering what's going on over there. They've been brought in a lot of experts and academics to talk about it as well. The Economist, the Washington Post has done a very good job. And also Al Jazeera English, which runs a YouTube channel that anyone can watch at any time, has brought in a lot of good commentators to discuss and debate what's going on in Greece. So I encourage you to check that out. Next up, it was a weird week in the world of sports this week. First off, an emoji battle broke out yesterday involving basketball star DeAndre Jordan, the Los Angeles Clippers, and the Dallas Mavericks, who are owned by Shark Tank star Mark Cuban. So a brief breakdown of what happened was, despite verbally agreeing to a new contract with the Dallas Maverick, Los Angeles Clippers pending free agent DeAndre Jordan was literally locked into his Houston area home yesterday with members of the Clippers, including their billionaire owner, Steve Ballmer, their coach, Doc Rivers, captain point guard extraordinaire, Chris Paul, star dunker, Blake Griffin, new Clipper, Paul Pierce, and lesser known bench player, JJ Redick, all traveled to DeAndre Jordan's personal home in Houston via private jet and helicopter to convince him to stay with the team. This all played out amongst the players themselves and the dozens of basketball writers on Twitter after a flurry of emojis were sent out on Twitter without context, including a rocket ship JPEG from Paul Pierce, which I imagine was because Paul doesn't necessarily know what an emoji is. So he gave it a good shot, and it was pretty funny regardless. This whole thing exposes a few issues for me personally. First of all, this exposes the archaic rules around NBA's current free agent policy. Basically, the NBA as a league doesn't allow teams to sign free agents to contracts until a new salary cap is determined several weeks after the end of the playoffs. Despite this, the NBA actively encourages players and teams to announce potential signings as soon as they are verbally, and I use verbally in quotes, agreed to. Despite nothing being signed and no official confirmation of the amount of money that a team can spend on their salary at that time. There's no reason the NBA can't determine the salary cap based off projections during the season, mid-season, and this whole scenario could have been avoided by just allowing teams to formally sign players at a set time after the last game of the year. Many people were astonished at this thing going down. People were locked and retweeting like crazy. Blake Griffin, who was at DeAndre Jordan's house, tweeted out that he didn't enjoy DeAndre Jordan's furniture layout and that he thought he could have done a better job. But many also considered it to be extremely unprofessional. This is a billion-dollar organization that was allowing not only its owner, star players, and head coach to play out a free agent negotiation, we'll call it, in the public sphere in a comical way using graphic text message symbols, and basically impeded the Dallas Mavericks' ability to sign a pending free agent within a social media sphere. I myself consider that very unprofessional. I mean, this is a league that we're supposed to be taken seriously. This is a sport that generates $1 billion of revenue every single year, and many people earn their livings based around this sport. And here they are determining the outcome of a roster negotiation using emojis. It just seems sort of crazy to me. But this is what the NBA wants. This is what the NBA writers want. Everyone was talking about basketball yesterday while no one was playing. So they got what they wanted at the end of the day. The next weird thing that happened in the world of sports involved New York Giant Jason Pierre-Paul. Pierre-Paul, the New York Giants defensive player, was injured in a bizarre accident on the evening of July 4th. It was widely reported last week that he had hurt himself lighting fireworks at a party, which is a common thing for many people to do over the holidays. We've all gone to see fireworks. We've all had fireworks set off in a public park or in our backyards, and everyone has a great time. We also know that some people like to play around with fireworks, even though they're not toys. They like to shoot Roman candles at each other or throw sparklers around and have a great old time. But this is incredibly dangerous, and I don't encourage anyone to do this. What wasn't reported, though, was the extent of Pierre-Paul's injuries. That was until midweek. So on Wednesday, well-known NFL reporter Adam Schefter tweeted out a medical chart of Pierre-Paul confirming that his right index finger had to be amputated as a result of the fireworks accident. It's unclear whether this injury will impact Pierre-Paul's career or even his current contract with the New York Giants. But what is clear at this time is that his legal right to privacy was violated. many reports initially pointed their fingers at Schefter, obviously not JPP himself. The real blame does lie with either the medical officials from the hospital who leaked the information or the team officials who leaked the information to Schefter. At this point, a legal complaint hasn't been filed, but I imagine a few people will end up in court and lose their jobs. A recent situation, funnily enough, similar to this, happened here in Toronto recently. A Toronto hospital employee was fined $50,000 for damages and eventually had their employment terminated for accessing Rob Ford's medical documents during his treatment for cancer. People's medical charts are highly sensitive, they're highly confidential, and no one is allowed to see them, or the media is definitely not allowed to report on them without that person's personal consent. Rob Ford obviously never consented to have his medical records be investigated by anyone other than his doctor, and the same thing is the case with Jason Pierre-Paul. He never consented to having his medical charts played out in the public sphere like that, which is extremely unfortunate. I mean, he suffered a horrific injury, he lost a finger. This could potentially impact his career as an NFL player, his livelihood as an individual, and as well, it could impact the rest of his life. But it does, I think, expose another problem within the sports media. And basically, this all begs the question, when will the sports media draw their line in any coverage? Essentially, this week, every NBA reporter commented on and speculated on a meeting between a team and a player that brought no changes to their roster whatsoever. Essentially, they made a story out of a non-story. Everyone speculated that DeAndre Jordan was going to sign with the Dallas Mavericks, but it was speculation. Nothing had been signed. They all speculated that the team headed over to his house to negotiate with him and lock Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, as well as other Mavericks players, out of DeAndre Jordan's house to basically subterfuge that negotiation for a new contract. But at the end of the day, nothing changed. When the next NBA season starts once again, DeAndre Jordan will be playing for the Clippers, and the Mavericks will not have DeAndre Jordan. So nothing's changed. Everything was status quo. They were able to make a story out of nothing and had millions of basketball fans absolutely enamored with what was going on yesterday, all through a few cleverly placed emojis. Also this week, every NFL reporter commented on the confidential details of an individual's medical chart. Is there nothing sacred to sports media anymore, or are they just looking to for content to fill the dead space in their increasingly brief off seasons? If you are like me and you get frustrated by the overblown speculation and rhetoric of much of the media, just tune it out, is my advice. You can check in to see if anything happened in the offseason once your favorite team starts playing again. You can check to see what the roster moves are when you need to draft players for any fantasy sports you play, and you can basically catch up with this stuff at any time. It's important to recognize that a lot of this media frenzy is totally self-created, and it's totally created to perpetuate the industry of sports media. It changes nothing. I mean, again, DeAndre Jordan didn't change teams. Totally status quo was achieved. So all this stuff only goes as far as we as fans wish to take it. And I think that maybe if we step back a little bit and consider that there are other important things going on in the world, we'll see less of this craziness play out in a public sphere. So finally today, my last headline involves money, specifically women on U.S. money. So for the past number of months, there's been increasing news and discussion of honoring a woman on an American paper bill to add to the esteemed memories of some old slave-owning presidents, a historic adulterer, and a former secretary of the treasury slash crazy person. On his show a couple weeks ago, John Oliver raised the point that a petition has made the rounds last year calling for Harriet Tubman, the famed leader of the Underground Railroad for former slaves, to replace former President Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. This campaign was acknowledged by the U.S. Treasury recently by announcing that a woman would be added to the $10 bill alongside the first Secretary of the Treasury and quote-unquote framer of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton. While we here in Canada may not be any better when it comes to the issue of gender equality in society and the workplace, we have had a woman on every legal coin minted here since 1952, and multiple bills and Canadian notes dating back to the time of Queen Victoria, including currently Queen Elizabeth on the $20 bill. We also have an anonymous science woman or a female scientist on the back of our $100 bill looking through a microscope. Now, this is nobody in particular, and it's supposed to represent Canadian advancements in science, but it's also a pretty progressive idea in terms of the world as a whole, that we have women on our formal currency. As usual, we are way ahead of our friends in the South on an issue like this. So I believe that the decision to split the $10 bill in the U.S. between a yet-to-be-determined woman and Andrew Hamilton is the wrong one. I think the Treasury should take its steps further by removing Hamilton entirely and Jackson from the $10 and the $20 bills respectively and replace them with two women who have made an impact on U.S. society and history. There are plenty of qualified choices for this. The aforementioned Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, Eleanor Roosevelt, the original writer of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first female Supreme Court justice. Hell, even Condoleezza Rice would be an appropriate candidate as a former Secretary of State. Anything to replace perhaps two of the worst people in American history. To give you a brief background on Alexander Hamilton and Andrew Jackson, I've written this brief background here for you. So, Hamilton, while a signer of the Declaration of Independence, he was also certifiably a crazy person. He's most famous for losing a duel against the sitting vice president in 1804. For this, he ended up dying, he lost that duel, and that was the end of his life. He was also an anti-democrat in the sense that he was anti-democracy. He argued for and supported the establishment of an American monarchy where the president was elected to serve a life term. George Washington famously downplayed this option and helped to determine the current system. Next, Andrew Jackson, currently on the $20 bill, was also not such a great guy. Aside from being the seventh president of the United States and one of the founders of the Democratic Party, as it was known at the time, he owned hundreds of slaves from 1804 until his death in 1845 on his family ranch. He killed a man in a duel in 1806, which apparently is now a theme for people on American bills, and he was directly responsible for the creation and use of patronage and rewards for government supporters in the U.S. political system, which reverberates to this day. In 1830, he signed something called the Indian Removal Act, doing just that to people living on land west of the Mississippi River. He had promised and formally given them less than a year earlier that land, and Jackson decided to remove them entirely from it by an act of Congress. This began a series of wars with various Native peoples and resulted in something called the Trail of Tears, which is something that you should Google and read about if you haven't already done so. So, getting back to the heart of this discussion, I say it's high time for the United States to put multiple women on their bills. They need to get with the times, catch up with us here in Canada, and just remove some of those guys from their bills. I think that we could also use a change in some of our currency. Although I do like Wilfrid Laurier on the five. A lot of people have a problem with Sir John A. Macdonald, even though he was our first prime minister. Maybe let's think about getting some more females on our bills. Let's throw Roberta Bondar on there. Let's throw Haley Wickenheiser on there. Let's just get everybody involved and see how cool we can make our money. So next up is our guest this week. Again, our guest is Matt Natto. He is a stand-up and sketch comedian, and you can catch him and the Sketchersons in their weekly sketch comedy review called Sunday Night Live at the Comedy Bar on Bloor Street. So here's Matt. Okay, so as promised, I'm joined by Matt Natto on the phone. Matt, thank you for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm great, Shane. Thanks for having me.
Hey, not a problem. So Matt, I guess my first question for you today is, tell me about the Sketchersons. What do you guys do and where can people find you?
The Sketchersons is a weekly sketch comedy show. It's called Sunday Night Live. We do it every single Sunday, 9 p.m. at the Comedy Bar, at Comedy Bar Bloor and Ossington. And yeah, it's the same format as Saturday Night Live. We do a brand new show every week, different sketches. We never do the same sketch twice. And we'll usually have a host, so we'll have like a celebrity. So in the past, we've had, Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall. We've had Greg Proops from Whose Line Is It Anyway? We've had some wrestlers from back in the day, like Bret the Hitman Hart hosted.
Whoa.
Yeah, some pretty cool stuff. So, and also we'll just have local comedians that are pretty popular around Toronto. And it's a great show. It's a lot of fun. Everybody loves it. Everybody has a good time. And it's worth it.
Yeah, that I can attest to. I've been a few times, as you know, and I always have a really great time there. The Comedy Bar is always such a great venue, and they have really fantastic beer on tap, so it just makes it a double win.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've tasted it many times.
Excellent. So, Matt, how did you get involved with the Sketchesons? Why don't you tell us about your experience getting involved with them as a group?
I've watched them for years. Like, if you do sketch comedy or you do stand up, you spend most of your time at Comedy Bar, and I used to watch their show. I mean, they're always hanging around Comedy Bar, and I used to watch their stuff Sundays, and it was incredible. And I found out they had auditions. So 2 years ago, I auditioned, but I didn't get in 2 years ago. And then back in the fall, they had another round of auditions, so I got in this time. And that's it. That's all she wrote.
Excellent. So, Matt, do you do any comedy or performance outside of the Sketchersons, or is that sort of your main right now?
Well, it's the most solid one. Like, it's every week, so I'm always there. But I also do sketch comedy with a friend of mine, Aaron Peaver. We're called Alcoholics. We do shows around Toronto, and we just recently finished a 6-show deal at the Ottawa Fringe Fest, which was pretty well reviewed. Everybody had a good time. It was a lot of fun. We're just like a duo, sketch duo. And sometimes I'll do stand-up from time to time as well.
That's excellent. That's great. Yeah. So I do apologize for not getting out and promoting your guys' show at Ottawa Fringe. I know I promoted our mutual friend Sandy's show, but you know, that's on me. So I do apologize for that one, buddy.
That's okay, man.
How was your experience at Fringe though? Did you have you and Aaron have a good time?
Oh, it was excellent. I mean, I'm from Ottawa originally, so it's like I was like a teenager all over again. I got to stay at my mom's, eat all her food.
That's the best.
In the backyard. It was great.
Yes.
Yeah, I got to revert to my teenage self again. It's fun. But I mean, we did spend a lot of time, like, you know, promoting the show is the main thing you got to do too. So we did a lot of footwork, walk around, postering, handing out pamphlets, trying to get people to come see the show. So, you know, there's that side of it. But it was excellent. The festival was great. Everybody was super supportive. It was a really, really fun thing to be a part of.
That's awesome. So, Matt, how did you get your start in comedy? So what really inspired you to start performing sketch or stand-up or wherever you got your start?
I don't know. It's just like coming from my family's kind of wild. They're all pretty hilarious people, so that really inspired me. I mean, just they're all just naturally funny. We're all funny with each other, and it's just sitting around at the dinner table, you know, just everybody's just making their own jokes. Everybody's cracking each other up, and that's kind of where, like, my love for it started. And I guess when I was in junior high, I found improv, because I didn't really, you know, I was a, you know, class clown kind of guy. And then someone told me about improv, the improv team. So I started going after school and just really started falling in love with that. And then I really got into sketch comedy around the same time. So, like, I watched a lot of Saturday Night Live and huge Monty Python fan. Like, I own every single episode of Monty Python, and Kids in the Hall, like, I grew up watching too. So it was, I love that. So, I mean, that really inspired me to be a part of that world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's sort of the one takeaway that I can take. So many people that I've spoken to, just friends and, you know, just in general conversation, got their start in comedy and performance, you know, just at home, you know, with being funny and, you know, just having funny family members and being encouraged to just sort of be yourself and talk about funny stuff at home and at school amongst friends and stuff. And so it's really neat to see how that sort of sparks the flame. And as you get more passionate about it, as you go on, and stuff sort of just starts to happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It all starts with the family for sure.
Yeah. And so you mentioned doing improv. Were you were a part of your high school's improv team in Ottawa, I'm assuming?
Yeah, that's right. At Immaculata High School.
Hey, IMAC. I actually also did improv in Ottawa when I was in high school as well. So did you guys compete in the Ottawa Improv Games?
We did. We competed in the games. Never won them, but it was fun. I loved it. It was great. It was wild. I mean, I'd love to, like, if I wish I had back in those days, I wish I had the internet, you know, so we could have seen some of that stuff. You know, it could have been recorded so I could see what kind of stuff I was doing. Probably didn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense to me now. But I mean, it's just a bunch of teenagers going wild, you know, making each other laugh and stuff like that. It was so much fun. But yeah, I wonder how much my, you know, style of comedy has changed since then.
Yeah, it would be interesting to sort of have that and see how your personal comedy has developed. But I mean, regardless, the great thing about it is that you're right. It's just friends being crazy and teenagers getting all this manic, like, energy out in front of people for probably the first time. I know it was my first time really doing any sort of performance in front of a large group of people that I didn't know, like people I wasn't related to or friends from school or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was such a great experience. I guess just that feeling too from doing shows, because doing shows like in front of those big crowds and just feeling that response and that energy kind of, you know, attracted me to the comedy world too, because of that feeling you get when you're up there and like a joke goes really well or a bit you're doing goes really well. I guess it all kind of stemmed from just doing those improv games too, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's got to be the same thing for like successful athletes, right? That ability to make people get a reaction out of people or make people laugh is a really powerful thing. And, you know, I guess with great power comes great responsibility in that respect.
Yeah, great responsibility to keep being funny.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. It's funny though, because I remember when we were doing the improv games. I mean, it's my friends from that improv team in high school are still some of my closest friends now, and we still stay in touch. So it's great we were able to nurture that relationship. But you mentioned it would be neat to see how your comedy's developed. We don't have any. I don't have any like video evidence of what we were doing either. And at the time,
No.
At the time, it seemed like, oh man, we're so funny. We're breaking all these barriers.
Yeah.
I remember
the only times I could say but.
Yeah, exactly, and make a fart joke that makes people laugh. And
yeah,
I remember we would practice and stuff. And because one of the for those who are unaware, for improv games traditionally you're given it's four or five set events you have to do, and they're based around a structure. So be it a character, a theme idea, a situation, stuff like that, and you develop a sketch using suggestions from the audience. One of them always has to be life, though, which is more serious, and it's not, you know, it's about...
Yeah, the life games, I remember that.
We always hated them, and I remember we would... You know, when you're a teenager, you get all this angsty, like, boy-girl energy, and we were like, we only have girls to do life, because life is for girls.
Yeah, it's so stupid.
Yeah, it is.
It's so funny, like, thinking back, we used to just do, like, teen dramas every time.
Yeah.
It was, because that's all we know, it's like, oh... You know, Billy was caught smoking a cigarette. Oh, his parents are so mad.
Yeah, or Becky's pregnant, and what are you going to do about it?
We had a very, like, narrow view of the world then, so we didn't really know what else to, like...
Talk about, yeah.
It brought the mood down, too. I wonder if they still do that, because, I mean...
I volunteered...
I don't see any serious improv games, like, since then. I've never seen... serious improv. I don't know if people really would want to, you know? So it's just funny.
I can't tell you that. I know it's still around and they still do the life thing. I my last winter in Ottawa, I actually volunteered at the games of the NAC just to do back of house stuff like that, get the kids ready to go. And it's so funny to see that it's a different group of kids from like a different generation, but it's still the same thing. Like they're trying to be serious. Yeah. They have no idea what life is like, which is just so funny to me.
It's the same crap, right?
Yeah, it is. My last sort of anecdote is I do remember so vividly, specifically one time, it's burned into my memory. We were at the NAC and we were given a character, and I can't remember if it was just like a theme event or it wasn't our character situation. It was probably just a theme event, but we developed this one character, and it was just so in the moment. It was so weird and stupid, but it was like this giant talking calculator that dominated the universe. And the only way you could defeat him was by asking him what the value of 0 divided by 0 was, and that was the way we saved the world. And I don't know if you saw, apparently, like, Siri, like, on the iPhone, that's the Siri's getting all sassy about that question, and it's just funny to me that I came up with this, like, that 10 years ago.
Did you ever have to be a chair?
Oh, yeah, I would do chairs. I was also really good about standing on blocks and being a ceiling fan.
Yeah. Because I was a chair for a whole scene, crouched down, and I kept it. I don't know how. Like, I thought my thighs were going to explode, and people, like, would sit in me like a chair. And I mean, like, improv now, when I go at Comedy Bar or wherever, Second City, like, nobody, they don't do that really anymore. Like, you're not, like, a chair or a tree. Like, you have to be in the scene as a that's something.
Yeah, you have to contribute to it. But I guess, yeah, you know, when you're trying to when you're trying to involve kids, you gotta get, if they don't want to do something, you can't just be like, get out. You gotta
do something. Exactly. And like also in those days, like they give you like whatever 30 seconds to just talk about what you're gonna do.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? The huddle?
The huddle, yeah. The huddle. I remember we, when the, our, in grade 12, we were like gonna break this barrier and be so groundbreaking. We would go no huddle for the theme one, which is like the most random one. And we were man.
But like, that's how improv is, you know, you don't, there's no huddle. You just get right into it.
Yeah, exactly. You just feel the moment. You take what people offer you and you go with it.
That's it, man.
Yeah, man. So I guess moving away from sort of the sketch stuff, I guess the less improv stuff, but what's sort of your process for developing new material, and where do you start when you write like a new sketch for Sunday Night Live, or when you're trying to develop a new part of your stand-up routine?
Well, with Sunday Night Live, like you're writing two or more new things every week. Like that's, there's a high demand for material in the show. So how I go about it is just like, I don't know. My best time is like when I'm lying in bed just before I go to sleep, something will just pop into my head that I think is funny.
Yeah.
And I'll make a note of it. So I'll just like, I keep my phone by my bed and I'll just write it down. And in the morning I'll say, okay, I remember that. And then, so sometimes stuff will just happen. I'll just think of it. And then also just sometimes if I'm just out with my friends and you know, I'll just start riffing something ridiculous. Like I'll just make up a character in some way or, you know, we'll just kind of have a little bit of improv, you know, amongst ourselves. And sometimes stuff comes from that, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's just, I don't know, I think I've just been doing sketch for so long, it's kind of, I'm always just ready for an idea, you know what I mean? So I'm kind of just open for that to hit me, and then I just get inspired by something and then just start writing and see where it goes.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that's sort of what happens. You become so familiar with what you're doing and the style of that it becomes organic, and you're just always able to recognize, oh, that's, you know, that's really funny. I can make some sort of story or situation around that.
Yeah, and I mean, what's great about the Sketchersons, there's the cast is so huge that everybody is completely different in their own way, like with what they write about and how they write and their style of humor. So like, with me, I'm like I'm about like characters and kind of absurdist. Like a lot of my stuff can be very absurd,
mm-hmm.
And high energy, and that's the kind of stuff I like. And then other people will draw their inspiration from real events like YouTube or the news or you know, stuff like that. So that's what's great about sketches. Like there's something for everybody to take away, you know?
Yeah, and I guess when you're in a big group like that, you know, there are so many different voices and everyone brings something new to the table, and then you guys sort of work together and you get like sort of like a hive mind. You're all sort of on the same level.
Yeah, it's really interesting, like, because I've been with the Sketchersons for about 6 months now and with the Sunday Night Live show, and people, you kind of start getting on the same page. Like, it's weird, like people will bring stuff in and sometimes we'll have some of the same kind of jokes in it because we're all kind of melding together, you know what I mean? And it's really cool to see. And then sometimes we'll have the same, like people will just have, like they'll both name the same person in the sketch, the same, like this guy, one of the guys in our troupe, two sketches were written for him, and in both sketches, his name was like Zach or something like that. It was really weird.
Yeah.
But like just little things like that, that kind of show that we kind of all meld together and yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I mean, Zach is a pretty funny name, so that'll happen.
Well, it's just stupid. it was a funny name and they both named the guy the same thing. It was, you had to be there.
Okay. Okay, buddy.
Oh God.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's great. So I guess sort of my final question here for you, Matt, is who would you say your comedy idol is? If you could pick one people, or maybe, I mean, you said Monty Python was a huge inspiration on you, but if you could pick one person or even one like made up character, what would you say inspired you?
I'm a big big John Belushi fan. I love what he did. He was cool. He was so great, and you know, you're just drawn to the guy whenever he was on camera, and he was so subtle, and in some ways, you know, in some things that he did, it's just like he just raised an eyebrow, and it was hilarious to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I for sure, John Belushi, big time.
That's a good one. I mean, much better than. I'll give credit to Jim Belushi, but John was clearly
Oh, poor Jim Belushi. Always in the shadow.
Always in the shadow. But I will say, buddy, John Belushi was hilarious, a legend. Just don't go the rock star route like him. I would miss you too much.
I don't have the money for it.
All right, buddy. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, Matt. And
Thank you, Shane.
No problem. Let the people know one more time where they can see you.
Okay. Well, if I didn't totally butcher this interview and I sound interesting enough to come see, or even if you don't want to come see me and you want to see the Sketchersons, we're every Sunday, 9 p.m., Comedy Bar, Sunday Night Live. Come check it out. Bring your friends. Bring your girlfriend. It's a good date. It's a good time. You know, if you're on a date, comedy's the way to go, man. You know, if you go in, you're laughing, you're having a good time. And, you know, and then, you know, you see what happens. You know, it puts you in a bit. It's way better than a movie because, I mean, you know, we have a bar there. But, I mean, I know they got the movies, the VIP movies.
Nah.
But anyways, Comedy Bar, 9 p.m., Sketchersons. Yeah, it's great. You'll love it. It's a different show every week, man. So, yeah, come check it out. And then have a drink with me after.
So that's my show for this week. Again, I want to thank Matt Natto for taking the time to join me today, as well as all of you for taking the time to listen to me. I'll be back again next week with a brand new show and a brand new guest. Again, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @STROneil. As well, you can subscribe to the show on YouTube and the podcast Shane's Show on iTunes and the iTunes Store. As well, you can email me at any time at shaneshow.to@gmail.com. With any news, notes, tips, info, feedback, comments, requests, anything you want, you can send me an email and I'll read it out on air. And I will take all of your suggestions to heart. Again, I just want to thank everyone for their patience while listening to this podcast. You may have noticed that some of the production elements have changed slightly from week to week. That's because I'm still sort of feeling this out, still trying to learn how to make a very good podcast and make it enjoyable to listen to. It's not going to be perfect. I totally understand that. Again, I'm just one guy doing this myself in a laundry nook, surrounded by a desk and a lot of shoes and a washer and dryer. So thank you so much for taking the time to listen to me and your patience in doing so. Take care, everyone. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you again next week.